of all, welcome to Tales of Power.
Thank you, Larry.
I have with me on the line David Icke from England, and I apologize for pronouncing your name Icke. I've heard it that way so many times that it's hard to make the switch. I've soon discovered that it's actually David Icke.
That's right. Eisenhower without the manipulation.
There you go. Eisenhower without the manipulation. Okay, I guess the first thing we should talk about, David, is just how it is that an ex-professional soccer player and television personality becomes a world-renowned conspiracy theorist, author, and lecturer.
Okay.
How
long is the first program? Well, what happened was I was a, like you said, a professional footballer. I was brought up in what we call in England a working class background and a big housing estate in a place called Leicester. And I always wanted to be a pro footballer, and I became one. But then I had very serious arthritis from the time I was 15 and playing for a team called Coventry City.
Right.
And as it progressed through to when I was 19, 20, and then my career finished just after I turned 21, it became increasingly impossible to play. I mean, it might sound bizarre now, and I look back, and it was really, but in the latter 2 years that I was a pro footballer, playing in a successful team, I was in agony every morning when we were training. And I became known as the club hypochondriac. There was always something wrong, but what they didn't know that it was the same thing wrong. So when I was limping in the warm up to preceding the real hard training every morning, I would have a bit of a blister on my foot. I would have a bit of a pull in my calf. It was all the same thing. It was the arthritis.
Right.
Because of course, if the club knew that, then there'd be a new goalkeeper coming in. So. But what that did, it really did activate in me a determination not to give in. And but what happened at the end of that season, when I was just 21, is that I went to bed one night, and funnily enough, for a few weeks, the arthritis had improved dramatically, and nobody's what they call remission, but it seemed to me that it was going. And I got into bed one night and remember looking at my knees, and the kind of swelling had gone down for the first time that I could remember. Then the next morning I woke up, and you know when you're in this kind of half sleep and you're just waking up, I was in that state, and I realized I couldn't breathe. And I tried and tried to gasp for breath, and I couldn't. And eventually I did. And when I did, I thought I was going to die. And when I did, I realized I got all my body senses back, that every joint in my body was agony, like someone was sticking a knife in it. And that was the end of my football career.
That was it?
Yeah. Benito. Never played again. So I'm just 21. I have no other profession. I left school at 15 because I wanted to be a footballer. I never took an exam in my life. Knew nothing about anything, really, apart from football. And decided I want to be a journalist, and I got a job on a newspaper only because no one else wanted it. You know, if the newspaper circulation had been human, it would have been on the life support machine. You know, not even most of the people that work for it ever read it. You know, the irony is, again, that's the way the system works. It doesn't judge intelligence so much as the system's version of what it requires, in the sense that trying to get into journalism from a footballer. Who have this reputation of being a bit thick and all that stuff, was very, very difficult for one simple reason. They were saying to me, what school did you go to? What exam passage did you get? What university did you go to? And, of course, I went to none of them. But once I got in on this tiny weekly paper and then started applying for other jobs, no one was asking me about educational qualifications, only whether I was any good or not, which is ludicrous. Anyway, I progressed through radio and then became an anchorman with BBC Television and News and Sport, and became a news journalist for the BBC also, working on their national news bulletins and stuff. When I kind of reached my goal of getting into television, which was the ambition I threw out once my football career finished, was the whole point of going into journalism and newspapers was to get through to television. It became meaningless to me. It's supposed to be one of these kind of great professions, always on telly and all that stuff. It became totally meaningless and empty to me. I met so many false people. You were brilliant, darling. What was I like, kind of thing. And it really, it was a world I didn't take to at all. And also, what was happening by this time in the 80s is this, the environmental awareness was starting to gather, which really triggered something in me, because even when I was a kid back in Leicester, I used to go out on my bike a lot into the countryside, and I was seeing, you know, beautiful areas that I remember going under concrete. So I was kind of triggered by that. Now, I eventually...
You became a member of the Greens, is that right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of typical, though, of my life, where some unseen force seems to be opening and shutting doors and saying, okay, no more down this corridor, open this door, you're going there now. And I summed up by this remarkable kind of sequence of events that happened when I joined the Green Party, because I live on an island just off the south coast of England, the Isle of Wight, and I came here and in this environmental period of awareness emerging to live, and suddenly I started really wanting to get involved in this, and I started getting involved in environmental pressure groups here. But I realized that no matter how good the argument, the whole thing was decided whether something happened or didn't happen by the number of hands in the air at a local council, which didn't seem to be in any way related to the standard of the debate. But as I understood, and my God, this was really the start of me moving into a bigger understanding of the manipulation. The decisions were made before the council met. They were made in the Freemasons' Hall down the road from here in the afternoon, and then the council voted in the evening, irrespective of the quality of the debate. So I decided then that I needed to get involved in get among those hands in the air. So I contacted the Green Party and see if they had a branch here, and they didn't. They said, we'll start one. And so I did, and I joined the Green Party, and I called a public meeting, and people came, and we started a little Green Party and branch. And then I really wasn't going to take it any further than that at the time, but then we got this letter to, can we send a representative to the regional meeting, because we're now part of this southern region of the Green Party and stuff, and no one seemed to want to go from here. So I said, well, I better go. We better be represented by somebody. And I turn up, and we have all this naval contemplating getting completely nowhere. And then right at the end of the meeting, this is about two weeks after I joined the party and stuff, 3 weeks maybe, the chair lady said, our regional representative on the National Party Council is resigning. We need someone else. If anyone like to put their name forward? No one did. So I said, well, I better do it. Well, I'll do it. We've got to have somebody. So they vote me now a member of the National Green Party Council. I've been in the party no more than 3 weeks. I then go to the first National Green Party meeting that I was representative on, and they naval contemplate at a higher level, just off Regent's Park in London, and just before lunch, the chairperson says, would you, well, we need some people to speak for the party in the media this coming year. Would people put their proposals forward after lunch, right? So at lunchtime, this guy came over, never seen him in my life before, and he said, you're on television, ain't you? I said, yeah. He said, should you be confident in front of a camera when you ask him? Well, you suppose so. He said, well, I'll put your name forward. We don't put your name forward for a spokesman, right? By 5 o'clock that afternoon, no more than 6 weeks after I actually joined the party, I'm now the British Green Party's national spokesman. I mean, I had to go away and study the manifesto. I knew they stood for certain things, certain principles. I didn't know the detail by then. But this is what's happened to me, Larry, since through my life, is this amazing sequence which is still continuing, where a new area is introduced, and then suddenly everything happens so fast, and suddenly I'm in a different, totally different world to what I was just a few weeks before, and it's gone on.
Right. People have been describing it to me lately as quickenings that have been happening in their lives spiritually as well in the last, 10, 15 years, and especially in the last couple of years. There's been this real upsurgence, and it comes exactly how you're talking about.
So, yeah, well, the first book I ever wrote on these subjects actually was called Truth Vibrations, and it was, I gave it that title for this very phenomena you're talking about. There was clearly, back in the 90s when I wrote that, early 90s, there was clearly, even then, a demonstrable quickening taking place, truth vibrations, quickening vibrations that were beginning to wake more and more people up. And I think what we're seeing now in the world, particularly in the mass reaction by so many people to this war in Iraq, there is an awakening going on. And what I like about what I've seen in these demonstrations is that there's not just demonstrating against something, there's also an increasing awareness, streetwiseness, to the fact that agree to an agenda that has, you know, is unfolding.
Right.
And it's not just oil, although that's one level of it.
Exactly. I know that spiritual epiphanies are very personal affairs, but perhaps you can talk for a few minutes about the events that took place in the bookshop that day and the subsequent events that led to your spiritual awakening.
Yeah, well, what happened was that when I became a national spokesman of the Green Party, the Green Party used to get less than 1% of the national vote. You know, we used to hold meetings and, you know, sometimes the man would turn up with the dog, you know, it was
right.
No one wanted to know. But then suddenly there was a lot of environmental programs on television in this country in the mid-late 80s as this awareness, you know, emerged. And suddenly people started thinking environmental. And we had an election for the European Parliament in 1989 in which we got 15% of the vote, like 2 million votes. It was like staggering. And suddenly I was thrust into the national spotlight politically as a spokesman for this party that was now to be taken seriously, although only for a very short time. They've gone back to where they were now.
Right.
But what I saw, and this was another part of my understanding, which has been very relevant to what's happened since, I saw that although the Green Party claimed to be different, although it claimed to be the new politics and rejecting the old politics, once the Green Party in Britain became successful on a kind of level compared with the past, suddenly it became an old political party. There were people that said, oh no, we must reject this policy. Oh yeah, we agree with it, but we'll reject this one and we'll bring this one in because we'll get more votes.
Right.
And new politics must be speaking your truth that are irrelevant of the consequences. Otherwise, you're just the old way. So I got real sickened by what I saw, and I left. And in the same period, late 89, when I kind of withdrew from the Green Party, a very strange thing started happening to me. I was continuing to work for the BBC in television, etc., but every time I was in an empty room, or what appeared to be empty, there seemed to be another presence there. And I was looking around, you know, who's in the room? What is all this about? And this went on for ages. And then eventually, I remember, I was sitting in a hotel near the BBC in London, called the Kensington Hilton, when I was working for the BBC there. And I sat on the side of the bed in this room on my own, and I remember saying, if there's something there, would you please contact me, because you're driving me up the wall. and then this situation emerged about a week later, which you just referred to.
Right.
I was playing soccer down the seafront, just from where I'm sitting now, on the Isle of Wight, and with my son, who's now 21. Back in 1990 it was, yeah. And when we finished knocking the ball about, we were going to go down the seafront railway station to have something to eat. And when we got down there, the place was full, so we turned to walk back up into the town. And as I turned, there was a railway worker who stopped me. He wanted to talk about football and stuff. And when this chat was over, suddenly I realized that my son wasn't there. And I knew he'd be in this news shop where they sold books. Then he went in and read the books from time to time.
Right.
So I went in to say, come on, Gareth, we'll go up into the town. And as I said that and went to move back out of the shop, my feet wouldn't move. They were kind of stuck to the ground. And what I heard passing through my mind very strongly was, go and look at the books on the far side. Now, I knew the shop very well. I went in there regularly, and there were no books there of interest to me. They were all about perfectly formed English roses having relationships with perfectly formed, English soldiers and stuff,
right,
you know,
right.
Kind of what we call the Barbara Carlin stuff.
Sure.
So I had no interest in that, but I was so intrigued, and also my feet wouldn't move anywhere in the direction I wanted to go. So, and there was this kind of funny presence. It was kind of funny feeling surreal around me. So I'll go over and I look through the books. I didn't even look through the books, to be honest. I looked at the books, and one of them absolutely stared out at me, and it was a woman's face, and it was a book called Mind to Mind. And I was very, very attracted to this book, not by the woman's face, but by the book. Something said, pick that book up. So I picked the book up and looked at the blurb, and I saw the word psychic. And it was a book by a psychic who was telling the story of her experiences and all that stuff. And once I saw the word psychic, it really hit me, because I thought, hey, I wonder if this woman will be able to tell me what the heck is going around me with this bloody presence all these months. So I read the book in 24 hours, contacted the lady, and went to see her. And I went there a couple of times, hands-on healing, because what I said to her, to obscure any knowledge of what was going on, all I said was, I've got this arthritis, nothing's worked on it, I want to try hands-on healing. go there a couple of times, and we do that hands-on healing, and it's very nice, and we chat about things like other dimensions and stuff, which really, really synced with me. I've always rejected religion, but I've always rejected what we call science, scientific version of reality also. And anyway, I go the third time, and I'm lying there. I only went four times in all, and she's sitting on a chair next to this bench that I'm on, and she's got her hands about 6 inches from my knee, doing the whole hands-on stuff.
Right.
And suddenly I felt like a spider's web on my face, very, very strongly. And this took me aback, because I'd read in her book that when other dimensions or other consciousness is trying to lock into you, and sometimes you feel like a spider's web on your face. Funnily enough, I've never felt it since, only that time. And about 10 to 15 seconds after I felt this, but said nothing to her, I'm just slipping further down the bench going, oh, God, what's this? She launched her head back very strongly and said, my God, I've got to close my eyes for this one. This is powerful. So I'm going further down the bench. And what she said, that she was seeing a figure in her mind. Of course, these are all projections. They're not like physical beings in her head. These are projections to give her something she can relate to in terms of the world that she knows here. And she said that this figure is asking her to pass information through to me. And the first thing it said was, they're saying they know you wanted them to contact you, but the time wasn't right. You've not been brought here to be healed. You've been brought here to be contacted, but one day you'll be completely healed. Anyway.
So you were hearing this through her, though?
Through her, yeah.
Hearing yourself.
Through her, yeah. And then she started, which was interesting to relate to something I'd said in that hotel room, which you knew nothing about, like, would you contact me? You're driving me mad.
Right.
Anyway, she then reels off all these things, which sounded totally bizarre to me, that I was going to go out on a world stage, be world famous eventually, and I would face enormous opposition, but they, whoever they are, would always be there to protect me. That there was a shadow across the earth which had to be lifted. There was a story that had to be told. And that one of the lines was, one man cannot change the world, but one man can communicate the message that can change the world. And a series of other things relating to communicating suppressed information to people. Now, I at the time, I'm introducing the soccer on the BBC and the snooker and stuff, and I'm thinking, what? But virtually everything, if not everything, that was said at that time, March 1990, has either happened or is happening.
Right. Did you have an early fascination with psychics and
Nothing. But I've always been open-minded to it.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I've come across it, I've not gone, oh, that's a load of rubbish. I've always thought, well, I'm interested in that. Tell me more. But I hadn't really gone into it. Well, I was more interested in, just living my life, and
right.
It was very important. I mean, you know, when people get the wake up call, they really shouldn't dismiss the earlier part of their life as, oh my goodness me, that's irrelevant now. I've got my wake up call. I'm seeing life differently.
Absolutely.
Because you understand the world you live in more if you have lived it without it, not in awareness. You've lived it like everyone else, caught in the illusion. Because you can then relate to people still caught in the illusion, because you've been there, and therefore you know how they think and how they're imprisoned, because you remember how you were. So it's very, very important that all that stuff I went through in football, in politics, in journalism, and the media was very, very, very important to what I'm doing now. And without it, I wouldn't be as adequately kind of informed as I would be if with it happening.
Right.
So what happened then, just to kind of complete the circle of my life transformation, is that the BBC sacked me out of the blue, even though I had loads of letters of commendation. Suddenly,
right.
I get this letter saying, you know, what you see with hindsight, when you begin to understand the way that reality works, is that that was the BBC sacking me, but actually it was me sacking myself, because I needed to leave that behind completely and go in a completely different direction. So I wrote this book called Truth Vibrations about what was happening to me, and then when that went to press to the printer in early 91, I went off to Peru. Now, why the hell I went to Peru, I didn't really know, except that I had this overwhelming intuition to go to Peru.
Right, that was almost exactly 12
And funnily enough, the thing that changed my life more than anything was a decision I made just before I met that psychic lady we talked about, where I said, if my head and my intuition are ever in conflict again, I'm going to go with my intuition every time. And that's what changed my life. I got out of my head, the conditioned, this is what this world is, this is how you should act, this is how you should think. You've got a mortgage, you've got a